Welcome to Hub History, the show that brings you fascinating stories from Boston's history. This is episode 6, Jane Taupin, the Nightmare Nurse. Hi, I'm Jake.
And I'm Nikki. And this week we'll be talking about a serial killer nurse with terrific bedside manner. But first it's time to take a look at what's coming up this week in Boston history.
Monday is William Lloyd Garrison's birthday. The Boston publisher and radical abolitionist was born on December 12, 1805. On December 13, 1636, Massachusetts Bay Colony organized its militia into 3 regiments, which is now considered the founding of the National Guard. Happy 280th birthday to the Guard.
For Wednesday, I'd like to read a passage from a letter written on December 14, 1775. That reminds us what a dark time the siege of Boston was. Quote, "The distress of the troops and people at Boston exceed the possibility of description. There are advices in town of December 14th. Not a coal ship was then arrived. The inhabitants and troops are literally starving with cold. They had taken the pews out of all the places of worship for fuel, had pulled down empty houses, etc., and were then digging up the timber at the wharves for firing. Very poor clothing, and so scarce of provisions that they had been eating horse flesh for some time. Neither vegetables, flour, nor pulse for the inhabitants, and king's stores so very short, none can be spared from them." We'll have a link to the full text of that letter in the show notes for this week's episode.
On December 15th, 1875, the new Old South Church was dedicated in Copley Square. The 1872 Great Boston Fire burned the homes of much of the congregation and almost burned the original Washington Street Church itself. As the congregation moved out to the newly created Back Bay neighborhood, the church was granted a prime piece of land in Copley Square and opened just a few years later. Friday is an important anniversary. On December 16th, 1773, some Bostonians dressed up in costume and threw a bunch of tea into the harbor.
In December of 1773, 3 ships arrived from England loaded full of the evil weed, as tea was now called in Boston. Furious colonists demanded that it be sent back to England unopened. Governor Hutchison refused. Finally, on a dark night in December, the Patriots decided to take matters into their own hands. Stocky Sam Adams, most daring of the Patriots, gathered over 100 men. In the dark alley, the men met to disguise themselves as Mohawk Indians. They wrapped themselves in blankets and smeared their faces with soot from the smithy. In the middle stood Henry Knox and Ebenezer Hodge. Finally, Adams gave the word.
Who knows how tea will mingle with salt water? To the harbor, Mohawks!
Meanwhile, the 3 tea ships, the Dartmouth, the Eleanor, and the Beaver, floated peacefully beside Griffin's Wharf. A sleepy sentry leaned against a piling, listening to the lapping of the waves. But what was that? The sentry looked up, startled. Down Milk Street, swinging lanterns and hatchets, came a wild-looking crowd of...
Indians! Indians! Come on! Indians!
Indians? In Boston?
I see them with my own eyes! Look! Look!
But those aren't Indians.
Greetings, Captain. We've come for tea. Hand over the keys to the hold and nothing else will be disturbed.
This is treason.
Let's have the keys, Captain.
That tea is worth a fortune.
Our liberty is priceless. The keys, Captain. All right, Mohawks, let's get to work.
For 3 hours, the Patriots hauled heavy chests of tea from the holds of the ships, burst them open with tomahawks, and heaved them into the harbor. Near midnight, the last chest was hoisted from the hold and heaved overboard.
Come on, you fishes! Drink to the king!
The colonists had made their move. There was no going back.
That clip is from the 1983 Fisher-Price Spellbinder dramatization, The American Revolution. I learned more U.S. history from that bright yellow cassette tape than I did in any class I ever took, which is probably a sad commentary on my education.
For Saturday, remember Arthur Fiedler. The longtime director of the Boston Pops was born on December 17, 1894. He brought the Pops into the modern era, playing pieces from film scores, pop songs, and show tunes, but he achieved national fame while conducting the Bicentennial Pops concert at the Hat Shell on July 4, 1776, in front of a national television audience. Fiedler was conductor of the Pops from 1930 until his death in 1979. And finally, speaking of music in Boston, this Sunday is December 18th, and that's the date in 1854 when the Boston Music Hall opened. Boston Music Hall was a large theater located about where the Orpheum is today.
As a music fan, the Pops and Boston Music Hall are delightful topics. So let's switch gears to get onto something a little darker, Jane Taupin.
Jane Taupin is Boston's lesser-known serial killer. Now, she really gets overshadowed by the Boston Strangler, but I think the facts around Jane Taupin are actually a lot more fascinating and really a lot more disturbing. But before we get too far along, I want to define what we're talking about here. Now, the FBI is pretty vague in defining serial murder as the unlawful killing of two or more victims by the same offenders in separate events.
That's not really how laypeople use that term, though. I associate serial killers with some kind of common intent, a thread that connects the killings, and that distinguishes them from when a person kills multiple times, but just in different crimes, like I killed somebody in a bank robbery this week, and then I killed somebody in a home invasion next year.
Right, but it turns out, at least from my research, that serial murder isn't really a legal term. It's more of a pop culture term, though, you know, of course, the courts and criminal justice system recognize the phrase and the concept.
And it stems from a German word, right? Serienmord?
Yes. Per the Oxford English Dictionary, the term serial killer comes from a film review in the 1960s, which references a German expressionist film from 1931. So, I do have a broader definition, though. A person who murders three or more people, usually in service of abnormal psychological gratification, with the murders taking place over more than a month and including a significant break, which is often called a cooling off period. So, full disclosure, this is not legal or scientific, it's Wikipedia. But I think it describes the general public's understanding of serial killing, with the abnormal psychological gratification being the common theme. And ultimately, this is a history podcast, so I really had to stop going down this psychology true crime rabbit hole. Jane Taupin was a nurse who, from 1885 to 1901, preyed on the sick and elderly throughout the Boston area, using her access as a nurse to murder at least 31 victims, which is the number that she confessed to, including three at Mass General in 1889. Jane was born Honora Kelly to Irish immigrants in 1857. Her mother died of consumption when she was young, and her father was known as just a combination of drunk, eccentric, and total crackpot, which are their words, not mine. I've seen several references to him called Crackpot Kelly. Now, there's a rumor that he sewed his eyes shut while working as a tailor, and it isn't really documented, but that's the kind of character that we're talking about here. However,
crazy one.
But we can't really say to what extent this would have impacted her, because when she was six, her father dropped her and her sister off at the Boston Female Asylum, which was an orphanage for girls, and presumably she never had any contact with him after that. But it's certainly not an auspicious start to life, and in less than 2 years, She's placed as an indentured servant in the home of Mrs. Ann Topin in Lowell, Massachusetts. And though she's never formally adopted by the Topins, she takes on their surname and eventually becomes known as Jane. Now, Jane paled in comparison to her foster sister. Jane is overweight, she's emotionally troubled, and she's prone to extreme jealousy. But at the same time, she's a very promising student. And I found a Lowell Sun article in 1938 at the time of her death that stated that in her schoolwork, as in her profession in later years, she was one of the leaders of her class, brilliant and aggressive in all things. But despite academic promise, she's left at the altar at age 19, and with no other marriage prospects and not wanting to be a domestic servant for life, she begins training as a nurse at Cambridge Hospital in 1887.
I was really struck when you said that Jane was indentured to the Topin family, because I picture indentured servitude as being something that happened much earlier in American history. But I guess it wasn't actually technically outlawed until the 13th Amendment after the Civil War. Anyway, during Jane's residency, she used her patients for experiments with morphine and atropine. She experimented with how the two could be used to bring a patient close to death, revive them, and repeat the cycle. Morphine causes breathing to slow and will put a patient into a coma, and then atropine would revive them, but ultimately lead to painful spasms and death when given as an overdose. She would spend a lot of time alone with those patients, making up symptoms, falsifying charts and records, and medicating them to drift in and out of consciousness, up to a state of delirium, and then back into a near-coma state. She later confessed that she derived a sexual thrill from patients being near death, coming back to life, and then dying again. She'd get into bed and lay with them and hold on to them while they died. There is one account from a patient, Amelia Finney, who survived Jane's care in 1887 and described how Topin gave her a bitter-tasting drink, climbed into bed with her, and held her and kissed her face frantically. Amelia recalled it the next day, but thought it had been a dream. It wasn't until the time of Jane's trial that she realized that this incident had really happened.
It's worth noting that this is quite rare for female serial killers, who usually murder for wealth or some type of material gain, but not sexual motivations. However, her later accounts and the professional opinions of the psychologist who evaluated her are somewhat conflicting when it comes to her motivations, meaning that she may have lied to support a defense based on her mental state. But I do have an interesting quote from her. "When the climax of my mania passed, I realized what I had done. I have known that my patients were dying. Then my greatest thought was to resuscitate them. I have then worked over them, trying to bring them back to consciousness. I have sent for doctors and other nurses and tried my best to save them. Sometimes I have been successful, but many times the poison was too much. They were beyond recovery and they died."
Regardless of motive, at that time there was very little supervision or oversight in hospitals, and her activities continued unchecked. And you have to wonder how much she is the reason behind the supervision and oversight in hospitals today. But to the casual observer at the time, she probably seemed like a very dedicated nurse, very compassionate, spending so much time comforting her dying patients. In 1889, she was hired by Massachusetts General Hospital, where she was able to murder three more victims before she was fired for theft.
And this is where it takes a darker twist.
If you can even imagine something darker than this has been already.
It goes there. Now, despite having a reputation as being a good caregiver and a compassionate nurse, there are now suspicions that follow her, and mostly it's really around the theft that happens, but it prevents her from taking a position in another hospital. And so she begins working as a private nurse, catering to Boston's elite, and this is ultimately what allows her to transition to killing entire families. She also begins to kill outside of her patients. She kills landlords that she owes rent to, She kills a friend whose job she hopes to steal, and she eventually kills her foster sister in 1899. Now, she'd later say that this was the first time that she had killed out of hate. And this is not a flare-up of rage. It is completely premeditated. She invites her sister to visit her on the Cape. She takes her on a picnic to the beach and gives her a glass of mineral water with strychnine. The next day, her sister is too ill to get out of bed. And rather than nursing her back to health, Jane has killed her within 2 days. And she later confessed, "I held her in my arms and watched with delight as she gasped her life out." At the same time, her brother-in-law does thank her for caring for his wife so dutifully. And so you can see that she really is able to maintain this act. But in time, she gets reckless. In 1901, she moves in with elderly Alden Davis and his family on Cape Cod to take care of him after the death of his wife, who she herself had conveniently murdered. Her next victim in the Davis family is the youngest daughter, Genevieve, though Jane did start rumors that Genevieve committed suicide. Alden went next, and then the older daughter, Minnie, is ultimately killed with an enema of whiskey, water, and morphine. And while Minnie was dying, Jane comforted her 10-year-old son.
You're right. This got wicked dark.
So now she's out of work because she's killed the whole family. So she moves back to her hometown of Lowell and attempts to begin a relationship with her deceased foster sister's widow. To endear herself to him, she kills his sister. And she does this so that she can comfort him in his grief. And then she poisoned him so that she could nurse him back to health. Now, sensing that things are still not going her way, she even went so far as to poison herself to become more sympathetic. And she actually does almost die. But for whatever reason, the brother-in-law doesn't take the bait, and he sends her out of his house before it's too late.
Meanwhile, Minnie's father-in-law was suspicious at this rapid series of deaths and the fact that Jane had been in debt to the family. In fact, the first member of the family was killed when she went to see Jane about collecting payment. The father-in-law ordered a toxicology exam on the bodies, and the report found that they had been poisoned. On October 26, 1901, Jane was arrested for murder. By the time of her trial in 1902, she had confessed to 31 murders, although it is thought that there were as many as 100 victims. Given the state of hospital record-keeping at that time, we can never know the exact number.
Now, it's important to note that at this time, the turn of the 20th century, serial killers were not a class of criminal that people were really aware of outside of Jack the Ripper. And there was definitely no well-known precedent for a female serial killer. And so the judge and jury, I have to imagine, just assumed that any woman who would do things like this must be insane. And she's found not guilty by reason of insanity and committed for life in the Taunton Insane Hospital. The jury only deliberated for 27 minutes.
But irony caught up with her in the end, right?
Yes. Although she lived to the age of 81, she was convinced throughout much of her confinement that someone was trying to poison her.
That's a bit of poetic justice. But I want to know, whatever happened to that fiancé that jilted her and presumably avoided becoming her first victim?
Well, interestingly enough, she mentions him in her writings later in life, saying, "I still laughed and was jolly, but I learned how to hate, too. And if I had been a married woman, I probably wouldn't have killed all those people. I would have had my husband, my children, and my home to take up my mind."
Well, I don't know. That sounds like wishful thinking to me.
Okay, where can people find out more about Jane Taupin?
We'll have a link to a book that goes into the details of Jane Taupin's life and crimes, Fatal: The Poisonous Life of a Female Serial Killer. We've also posted some information on the history of the Home for Little Wanderers, which traces its roots to the Boston Female Asylum, which was founded in 1799 in Boston's South End. The asylum took in young girls and trained them as domestic servants, typically placing them as indentured servants at age 11. They'd be contracted to a family for 7 years and released at age 18, with a minimum payment of $50. And this is appalling by today's standards, but at the time it was seen as a very compassionate solution to a social problem. What to do with orphans and other poor, unwanted children. The timeline we'll link to shows you not just the evolution of the agency, but also how the strategies and philosophies evolved.
And lastly, we'll post a link to photos comparing Jane in her first year of confinement, when she was healthy, against her second year, when she begins to believe that she's being poisoned through her food. She eventually loses about half of her body weight, and she had to be force-fed, which was a really horrific process. And you can find the show notes for this week's episode at hubhistory.com/007. If you want to get in touch with us, we're on Facebook at facebook.com/hubhistory, and our Twitter handle is @hubhistory. You can email us at podcast@hubhistory.com or go to hubhistory.com and click on the Contact Us link. And while you're there, be sure to click on the subscribe to see all the ways to subscribe to the show. If you subscribe on iTunes, please consider reviewing us there. Your reviews will help other listeners find the show.
That's all for now. We'll be back next time with a show on Boston Harbor's zoo shipwreck of 1938.